We're starting our new series today from the book of Ezekiel. Many of you have expressed excitement to me about it. Many of you have expressed nervousness. We will not be doing every chapter and every verse of this book. Some because of content, some because of the length of the book. But I hope that we will be powerfully impacted by this most unique of Old Testament books. Many of you have asked me, really? Ezekiel? Isn't that like one of the crazy books? Kind of. It is. You see things in Ezekiel you don't see anywhere else in the Bible. And it's very important that the hard, difficult books of the Bible, which Ezekiel is most certainly one, are not things we just shy away from. There's a reason God revealed these things to us, and there's a reason he revealed them the way that he does in Ezekiel. Much of what we're going to find in Ezekiel is not going to be common ground, perhaps, or familiar ground, I should say, for us. Many of us have never touched this book. It's understandable without some teaching guides alongside you why you might leave it be. But it is so powerful. Ezekiel didn't sit down to write this book as just kind of a big, long list of things that he thought we should all read at once. What this is a record of what God revealed to Ezekiel, and which he commissioned Ezekiel to then tell to his people while they were in exile in Babylon. Now, this also took place over several decades. So if Ezekiel reads to you as a very odd collection of things, that makes sense. It's not meant as just one letter that Paul would write. He's not writing a letter to the people of God. It's a record of all the different prophetic things that happened to him and that he passed on to the people of God. If you haven't read, this is called apocalyptic literature. If you haven't read much of the Bible of this genre, the book of Revelation falls into this, the book of Zechariah, most of the prophets, even some of Jesus' speeches about the end fall into this. Apocalyptic doesn't always mean the end, but it often is foretelling great events of the future, sometimes of judgment, sometimes of salvation. But what makes it apocalyptic literature is the style in which it's communicated. Often people have described that the best way to read this kind of literature is to view it like an impressionistic painting. If you look at an impressionist painting up close with a magnifying glass, it looks like a bunch of dots, doesn't it? You don't make a whole lot of sense. Or it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to you, I should say. If you stand back and, for lack of a better phrase, look at the big picture, yes, you see a delightful thing in front of you. Okay? If we zoom so far into all these images that Ezekiel's going to give us that we try to kind of decode all of it, it's going to make a mess of things. And God did not intend us to read it that way. There are things we're going to try to unpack. A lot of images we're trying to figure out, what does this mean? But again, not because we're trying to do some kind of Bible code exercise, but because usually these things are solved by the Bible itself. See, when God starts speaking to his people in apocalyptic ways, usually it's because they've entered into a time of judgment. And it's kind of God saying the following: you didn't listen when it was crystal clear, so now it's not going to be clear, but I'm still going to talk to you. If you want to figure it out, you got to do some work. But there are great things in store for those who, like Christ would say, he who has ears, let him hear. When Christ would say that, it was a clue like, hey, some of you are going to miss this. But if you want to figure out what it means, if you know your Bible, you'll understand what I mean. So Israel is entering into a time of judgment. And every prophet of God is kind of functioning like one of his lawyers. We have lawyers in this room, so no one roll your eyes, okay? See, Israel had broken their covenant with God, their contract with him. And so God is letting them know, okay, well, you knew what the stipulations were. If you broke it, there was going to be retribution. Breach of contract, as we would call it today. And so the prophets are like God's lawyers being sent to them saying, hey, remember, here's the terms. I've clearly kept my end of the deal. I delivered you. I've saved you. I've given you so much more than you deserve. Now, according to the terms you're supposed to follow, here's what you were supposed to do, and here's exactly how you have not done it. And so, you knew it was coming if you did this, so the following things will come upon you, horrible punishments, if you don't change. Well, Ezekiel is coming onto this a little late. The first wave of punishment has already come. So what Ezekiel's doing is announcing, not if you change, I'll hold back. It's too late. God said, I'm not going to hold back, but I will redeem you. So punishment, even more punishment's coming, people. But so is my redemption. Don't lose hope. So, a little bit of history before we dig into the passage here, because I think it'll help everything make more sense for Ezekiel. I don't intend on usually starting sermons with history lessons, and I don't even think it's a great practice to do it on a regular basis. But I think we might need a little bit for this passage to make some sense. So Ezekiel is born during what would have been, I think, an exciting time in Israel. It was during their last great hope of a king, King Josiah. Never had since David had there been a king as righteous as Josiah. And he began these huge reforms in Israel, trying to get rid of all the idol worship and all the immorality and turn them back to serving Yahweh. However, God even said, this won't stop your punishment from coming. It'll just stave it off a little bit longer. It's coming. There's no way around it. You have sinned too greatly for me to not punish you. But because of this righteousness here, I will hold it off a little bit longer. They'd already heard Isaiah come and go and rejected what Isaiah had to say. And Isaiah said, it's coming. So now, this is the time of the prophet Jeremiah. Ezekiel would have grown up under the ministry of the prophet Jeremiah and heard all his condemnations of the evil that was going on in Israel and of the punishment that was definitely coming, but pushed forward a little bit thanks to what Josiah had done. Ezekiel was a priest. He would have been born into a priestly family. He would have been trained his whole life to get ready to serve in the temple one day. However, Josiah's reforms were short-lived. And again, Israel is living under this death sentence. It's going to come, but as Josiah's reforms couldn't take full form as we would have loved. He dies fairly young in his 30s, late 30s. And the reason why is because the time surrounding Israel right now is a lot of international unrest. For centuries, in the north, the very cruel kingdom of Assyria up north had been oppressing everyone around them. 100 years ago, God used Assyria to destroy, 100 years before Josiah, not, you know, last century. 100 years prior to this, God had destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel for being godless and used the Assyrians to do that. Well, now the Assyrian empire is crumbling. Everyone has become so sick of their cruelty that they're rising up against them. And this upstart vassal, it's like a servant king, Nabopolassar, is bringing up the new Babylonian kingdom. And he is brilliant and powerful. And he strikes several deadly blows to the Assyrians. And the empire begins to crumble. Egypt down south, been the big power down south, is starting to realize this would not bode well for Babylon to take over here. So Egypt tries to reassert itself up in the north. For some reason we don't understand, Josiah decided to try to intercept the Egyptian army against the word of the Lord and was killed. And as a result, succession of his sons become king after him, and all of them are godless. At one point, Jehoiakim, one of his sons, becomes king, and he exhibits the arrogance that was infecting Israel for so long. See, when we hear the Bible said that Israel turned away from God, it's not they said, we refuse to worship Yahweh. What they did, like much of the ancient Near East, they wanted to collect as many gods as possible. Let's get in good with all of them, and then we're bound to be kept safe. So they kept serving at the temple. They continued to do their feasts, and that's why you hear so often in the Old Testament, God saying what? You honor me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me. Don't go through these emotions. Don't pretend I don't see that you're also worshiping Baal and everything else under the sun. But they thought, we're fine. We have God. Remember all those things he did to Egypt? We're going to be fine. But we don't want to trust only in him because that would be a little bit scary. There's a lot of other nations around us. Let's also worship some of their gods. Then you're bound to be safe. Also, their gods are more fun to worship because you can practice all sorts of immorality and get away with it. So let's do that too. So Jehoiakim is reveling in this kind of arrogance that Jeremiah called out time and time again. In Jeremiah chapter 7, Jeremiah says this to them, do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice with one another, If you do not oppress the sojourner, the fatherless, or the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, if you do not go after other gods or to your own harm, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land I gave of old to your fathers. Behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, only to go on doing these abominations? Has this house, which has been called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it, declares the Lord. Go now to my place that was in Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at first, and see what I did to it because of the evil of my people Israel. He's giving them a history lesson. He goes, remember, the tabernacle used to be at Shiloh, and your priests were evil there. And what did I do? Do you remember, Israel? I let the Philistines come in and destroy it and oppress you. And that's going to happen again. But this time, it's way worse than the Philistines. But Jehoiakim was the one saying, no. The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. We've got Yahweh on our side. Let's just keep checking the box and do everything else we want. And no one can defeat us. So he thought, I will also then go after Egypt for protection and paid heavily for it. That way I'll be safe from anybody else, especially Babylon. Well, not so long after that, if you're familiar with history, the Battle of Carchemish happens, and the Egyptian forces are wiped out by Nebuchadnezzar, the son of Nabopolassar, wiped out. And yet Jehoiakim thinks, you know what, I like my odds. I'm going to rebel against Babylon. So once Babylon took out Egypt, the Egyptian forces, they tried to go after all of Egypt's allies and demand that they swear loyalty to Babylon. Jehoiakim thinks, I've got God. I'll rebel. And guess what? He got killed. Probably no surprise. With Babylon laying siege to Israel, his son Jehoiachin becomes king and does the wise thing and surrenders right away. And to keep them from rebelling anymore, in 597, Babylon carries the first deportation, it's called, and carries 10,000 and or more of all their most gifted and bright and leadership-oriented people, including King Jehoiachin. Ezekiel is one of these carried off to Babylon. And they are then scattered around the country. Some are by the Kabar River, which we'll see where Ezekiel is. But this group of exiles is who this book is written to. You have to understand what their mindset is. The people at home have turned against them. What we find out is the people in Jerusalem said, ha, they're the ones who are the problem. God let us stay because we're good. He put his curse on them. But also in the ancient world, you have to realize for the Jews as well, being cut off from Jerusalem and the temple meant being cut off from God. We have no family. Anything you would have trained to do for your living, you're probably not doing anymore in Babylon. Maybe they'll give you a chance. So what are you doing now? Anything that would have defined you, God is gone, your family's gone, your livelihood is gone. And so we get the picture in Psalm 137 of what life was like for them in exile. Psalm 137 says this, by the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion, that is Jerusalem. On the willows we hung up our lyres, for our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Listen to what they say. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? It was unthinkable to them. You can't. I can't serve God. I'm cut off from the temple. God's not with me. And what the ancient mind would have thought is, did the Babylonian gods defeat Yahweh? Because often that's the way it would say, our gods defeated your gods, otherwise you would have won. But I think in their hearts, as we see, what they thought more was, God didn't lose. God turned against us. So we are absolutely hopeless. We've lost contact with God, home, family, everything that defined us. And so, amidst all that, we have this first vision of Ezekiel. So hear now the word of the Lord, Ezekiel chapter 1. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the exiles by the Kabar Canal, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Kabar Canal. and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud, with brightness around it, with fire flashing forth continually, and in the midst of the fire, as it were gleaming metal. And from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands, and the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each one of them went straight forward without turning as they went. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a human face. The four had the face of a lion on the right side. The four had the face of an ox on the left side. The four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces, and their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the wing of another, while two covered their bodies. And each went straight forward. Wherever the spirit would go, they went, without turning as they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. And the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures darted to and fro, like the appearance of a flash of lightning. Now, as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. As for the appearance of the wheels and their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl. And the four had the same likeness, their appearance and construction being, as it were, a wheel within a wheel. When they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went. And their rims were tall and awesome. And the rims were rims of all four were full of eyes all around. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went, and the wheels rose along with them. For the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went. And when those stood, these stood. And when those rose from the earth, the wheels rose along with them. For the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Over the heads of the living creatures, there was the likeness of an expanse shining like awe-inspiring crystal spread out above their heads. And under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward another. And each creature had two wings covering its body. And then they went. And when they went, I heard the sound of their wings like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the Almighty, a sound of tumult like the sound of an army. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And above the expanse over their heads, there was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness with a human appearance. And upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire, and there was brightness around him. Like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking, the word of the Lord. Did you listen to that stuff, kids? That's kind of hard to understand, isn't it? But one thing about this is not hard to understand. And I think maybe you guys have maybe felt something like this before. Have you guys ever gotten lost? Maybe at a store or at an amusement park or maybe just in your neighborhood? Whenever you get lost, it feels really scary, doesn't it? I remember when I would be lost, if I got lost as a kid, I would feel sick to my stomach. I was so afraid. And thank goodness my parents always found me, just like they've always found you. You know what would be even more scary than being lost? know what would be just awful? What if your parents left you somewhere on purpose? Wouldn't that be really scary if your parents just left you somewhere and drove away? Thank goodness your parents here would never do that, would they? Because they love you. But if you'd been left by your parents, wouldn't that feel so sad and scary? But you know, God's people, the people of Judah, felt that way right now. They were taken by people to a foreign country, and they felt that God had left them and didn't love them and would never help them ever again. Wouldn't that be a sad thing to feel? You know what's awesome? Our story here tells us that God did not leave them. In fact, God was more powerful there than they even imagined. You know what, kids? If you trust in Jesus, God will never, ever leave you. He can't, because he promised he never will. Even when you sin and do mean things, when you trust in Jesus, God promises he's going to forgive you and love you forever and never, ever be angry at you. Doesn't that make you want to change when you hear that? Doesn't that make you want to be kind and loving to thank God instead of being selfish like we so often are? So listen to the things in this story that talk about how much God was there with his people, even though they were worried that he wasn't. And remember, next time you feel like God doesn't love you, remember, that's a lie. God will always love you because he promised he will, okay? Think about that, all right? Thank you. So, I know you're all looking at the clock. How are we going to get through all this? I will do my best and not prolong things. So, given the background that we covered there, and how horribly hopeless and cut off from God and anything that had any meaning for them, these people were. You see how amazing it is that God comes to them like this. When it says the 30th year, it might sound confusing. He starts with the 30th year and then says, oh, by the way, it was the 5th year of Jehoiachin's exile. What are we talking about? It's Ezekiel's 30th year, which is when a priest would have been permitted to begin working as a priest. So Ezekiel would have trained his whole life to be a priest and then is plucked from that 5 years ago when he's 25 and set here in Babylon among the exiles. And so for him, he had to have wondered, what do I do? What's going to be my existence here? And when he says he's among the exiles by the river, it wasn't a group of them hanging out on the river's edge. His point is, there's a group of people who've been exiled from Jerusalem here, and I'm one of them. I'm living among them. And in my 30th year, God put his hand upon me. One thing that I wish our translation here did differently, if you look at verse 3, other translations put at the beginning of verse 3. Sorry, I'm losing my place here. Beginning of the last phrase, I should say. So you see the last phrase, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there? Many translators say, there the hand of the Lord was upon him. And again, it might not sound like a big deal to you. God's everywhere. Who cares? Not to them, he wasn't. Does that make sense? To them, God's back in Jerusalem. And we are here cut off from him with no hope. And all of a sudden you hear, there? The hand of the Lord is upon this exile? That God's not acting in the temple with the good Jews? He's out here? And we say the hand of the Lord, we've got to realize what that means. It does not mean kind of comforting little pat on the shoulder. Don't worry, buddy. I'm still here with you. Often, probably more often than not, the phrase hand of the Lord usually is God's hand doing punishing things, retributive things. Acting in destruction. There's also plenty of times when he's acting in redemption. What it symbolizes is God's hand is what gets God's will done. So if God's hand is upon you, you are being an instrument. God is doing something through you. So here's Ezekiel, hopeless with the exiles, and God's hand is upon him, saying, Ezekiel, get up. You are being commissioned and used by me for great things. We'll find out in future chapters Ezekiel's not so thrilled about that and has to bear with some rebuke. So then he begins to describe for us this vision. And it's a wild one, isn't it? One of the things we have to be careful of is this balance of not just chalk it up saying, well, who knows what that means, whatever, just move past it. No, God gave us detailed descriptions for a reason. We also should not pretend that we're going to get it all and give ourselves a artistic license to just decide what everything means. Okay, we've got to do our homework. What we see here in the beginning, we're going to find out in chapter 10, these four living creatures, he's called us, that he begins his vision with, describing these things he saw, are actually cherubim. And as such, we should view this whole vision as an invasion of Babylon by Yahweh. Because they are his, we're going to find it his, they are carrying his throne. And again, why it's all the more amazing that this is happening here, it's not in Jerusalem. And as Paul will tell the people in the book of Acts chapter 17, God doesn't live in temples made by human hands. Even if he's chosen to make his dwelling place there, he's not limited to that at all. Contrary to what everyone is currently thinking, the Jews in Jerusalem, the Jews in Babylon, and the Babylonians themselves. Everyone thinks, hey, we don't have to contend with him here. He's back there if he's anywhere. When you're describing a vision, here's why it's important that we try to figure out what different things mean. There's a reason God didn't just come say, I am here, Ezekiel. Okay, I'm here. He chose to represent the fact that he's here with a picture. And so it's important that we look at this picture. This is a bad analogy, I get it. But the way that collages are meant to be. Okay, someone will make, I mean, we had to do this in art class in middle school. You make a collage that represents you. Okay, and people look at this collage without seeing a picture of you and you realize, that's Tom. It's horribly boring. A lot of brown, a lot of gray, some books, and nothing else. Okay. But they get what it means because they see what the picture represents. Does that make sense? We got to look into this and see what is God representing to us by all these images, knowing that, again, there's still going to be mystery and we can't get it all. So, he describes these beings that have four faces, that have, he said, they're like humans, but they have calves' feet and four wings, two sets of wings. Now, that appearance is going to be something he would have seen very commonly in the ancient world. Not identically to that, but creatures, idols with four faces is going to be a common thing he would have seen in Babylon. Creatures that look somewhat like this would have even been in the Temple of Solomon that God designed. So seeing these kind of sphinx-like, winged, many-faced creatures is going to be a common occurrence. Right away, it's going to speak of power and godlike power. But obviously, God is utilizing imagery they're already familiar with to speak something much more. Whenever you have images often of this idea of faces in all directions, particularly the number four in direction, in line with geography or with space, it's going to represent very much like we saw in Psalm 139 when David's referencing all points of the compass, that God is demonstrating, I'm everywhere. There's nowhere free of me. And so these creatures, God's very powerful servants, have faces going in every direction, indicating there's nothing happening here in Babylon that God doesn't see. But keep in mind, we know, again from chapter 10, these are cherubim. And I wish the word cherub didn't exist in the English language with all the connotations we have, these rosy-cheeked, cupid-like, cute, kitschy, whatever, because biblical cherubim could not be farther from that. They are the stuff of absolute nightmares, right? Not cruelty nightmares, but like they are God's sign demonstrating, step across this line, you die. End of story. And where do we see cherubim utilized by God? They always communicate, God is holy, anything that's not cannot cross this line or you die. So the first cherubim we see is what? With a flaming sword outside the Garden of Eden saying, if you cross, you die. I preached a sermon about cherubim years ago, and a little girl in the congregation, I made my case about get rid of cherubs from your eyes, and these are awe-inspiring, terrifying things. A little girl in the church took my words to heart and drew her best image of a cherubim with a flaming sword and gave it to me at the end, and I was like, ah! She nailed it. It was so horrifying. I saved it, but I wasn't sure I wanted to. They show up again as a form of God's throne bearers on the Ark of the Covenant, which Uzzah finds out, if you touch it, you die. And it's woven, they're woven again in the great curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the rest, saying, if you enter into here inappropriately, you die. So these are God's messengers of, I am king, I am sovereign, I am holy. What I say goes. Try to oppose me and you die. So these beings who see all, not because they're all-knowing like God, but are empowered by him to be those beings, are invading Babylon. And they have lots of grandeur associated as well. All their faces are associated with what is the highest beast in its category or creature in its category. So even the Bible gives the face of a lion, okay, the idea of strength and ferocity, courage and royalty. The lion is what? Viewed as the highest of wild beasts. And you have the face of an ox, which was the highest of domesticated beasts. And you see throughout the ancient world, but also in Scripture, that oxes are associated with procreational power, or fertility, as the ancient world would have called it. But also the most valued of the domestic creatures. But then the eagle, often associated with grandeur and majesty and swiftness that's incomparable, is the loftiest of the creatures of the air. But then the final one, God's image bearer, the loftiest creature in the universe, man. And what God is saying is, yes, all these things that many of you associate with loftiness and grandeur, I have exponentially. And not only that, they aren't gods. They're my throne bearers. That's how much loftier and more powerful I am from all that you often look up to. And their imagery of fire shooting out from them and lightning coming forth from them as well. Imagery of fire and lightning throughout the Bible, start to finish, is a symbol of God's holy fires of judgment. But did you notice as we were going through that vision how much, if you were trying to visualize things, stuff's just flying all over the place at once? Motion, I think, is one of the things that characterized this vision. And we see it with these four servants, these four cherubim. You notice, he says they're going, darting to and fro in every direction, and they don't have to turn to do it. The idea that their faces, they don't have to veer, they can just go almost anywhere. And while he's watching them there, they're holding the throne, but they're also darting everywhere at the same time. Last big vision of God's holiness we saw would have been Isaiah's, where God is there on his throne with the seraphim crying, holy, holy, holy. But what we've seen here with all this motion is that throne, which is awe-inspiring, is not static. It is not stationary. It's not there in Jerusalem. It's not there in the temple. It's anywhere. It's everywhere. And not only can God see everywhere, but he is everywhere. So therefore, you here in Babylon are not cut off from him like you thought. If you noticed, talk about these wheels, and I wish I had a few hours of my life back. As I was looking for any kind of helpful visual that people have drawn to try to describe this scene here, you get the idea. Ezekiel's struggling for words because he keeps saying, as it were, a form of, a likeness of, but it wasn't actually this. He's struggling, and man, have these artists struggled. Holy moly. But one of the things they've gone nuts with are these wheels, and we've not understood what the wheels mean either, and people have even used the phrase, if you've come across it in literature, when you're describing this crazy labyrinth of a plot, you say, it's wheels within wheels. That's a fine way to speak, but this is not a way of God to describe mystery necessarily. We have these wheels, you know, one on an axis like this, another like this. Wheels within wheels, so they're going any direction at once. But even the wheels, it says, have eyes. Again, throughout the Bible, used as a symbol of life, but also in seeing and knowledge. And never outside of a truck show did I think I would hear people talking about tall and awesome rims. But that's what he's describing as the outer part of these wheels, covered with eyes. So everything is teeming with life and power and knowledge because it's characterizing the way God rules. Whether you're in Babylon as a captive or whether you're at home safe inside Jerusalem's walls. But why is everything teeming with life in this? In verses 21 and 22, you'll see the phrase two times where it says, the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. A better translation of that would be the spirit of life was in the wheels. Because it's God vivifying this entire thing. God didn't go out and just hire the coolest creatures he could find to be his throne bearers. He's obviously the creator of them all, and he is vivifying all of this with his power. What's amazing is that here in God-forsaken, quote-unquote, God-forsaken Babylon, among the most dejected of God's people that there's ever been, the single greatest vision God's ever given to date is this one. God's never revealed more glory to anyone, more power, more of a window into all he's doing than this vision. Exactly what they didn't expect to receive, because they're cut off, they're cursed, they're lost. But God is showing them, no, my spirit is here, and it's every bit as powerful here as it would have been back home. And so all this idea of motion and seeing and power and life and fire illustrate one major thing. God is invading Babylon, but it's on his terms, and it might not be the way even the captives, might not even be the way they want. God's presence with them, while they're horrified by the thought of being cut off from God, his presence might be even more uncomfortable. However, it's not for the sake of unnerving them. It's for the sake of ultimately comforting them. But they have to reckon with the God who they turned into a good luck charm back home and thought they could just pay off and do what they wanted. The words I read from Jeremiah before, he got charged with treason for speaking that way by Jehoiakim. How dare you say we can't use God as a luck charm? That's treason. So the captives who are not full of faith have to have their old vision of the way they viewed God torn out, and they need to be reprogrammed, as it were, with an accurate vision of who he really is. And so do we. Like I said with Corinthians, please don't let's not view this as a Babylonian captive problem. If any nation over the years has turned God into its good luck charm, we have. I'm not saying you in this room have done it. We have been very cozy as the world's missionaries, the best nation in the world. Maybe we are. So, it doesn't give us a blank check to say, well, as long as we're doing our job, being better than other people, we can keep God in a comfortable box where he doesn't have to rearrange my life, where he doesn't have to speak into my life and say things need to change, where I don't have to be challenged, maybe even frightened at times, realizing, man, you are so much bigger than I am. I treat you like you're so small, and that's so not true. Every one of us struggles to really take stock of the God of the Bible and worship him in reverence and awe, like he tells us to in the book of Hebrews, the way that we should. And every one of us also allows ourselves to think that because of our sin, we're cut off from God, which is an impossibility. So please, take these words to heart. Whenever God takes away things, like he did them, that had been their identity, which shouldn't have been their identity, but they were, you feel despair. And you can think, God doesn't love me. If God did love me, how could he take this away from me? It was a good thing that I had here. I wasn't even using it wrongly, I don't think. Well, how could he do this? And whenever we're tempted to think like they did, God turned away from me. God let me down. It's a cliche to say it, but it's a cliche for a reason. No, God didn't let us down. Our false impression of God let us down. The God we turned him into turned out not to work out. But he can't let us down. He can't turn away from us. So he's invading with his throne bearers coming in. And it reminds us very much, as I've mentioned twice now, of David's kind of being unnerved about God's impeding on him in Psalm 139. If you recall that from last summer, we tend to put a real cheerful spin on the beginning of this psalm. It ends cheerfully, but it starts off with David being claustrophobic with God's presence. He can't get away. He says this, "O Lord, you've searched me and know me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all of my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I can't attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to the heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. If I take to the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even your hand, even there, your hand shall lead me. Your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day. The darkness is as light with you. This is what is being communicated to Ezekiel. I'm here, but you have to reckon with me. On my terms, not yours. Christopher Wright, Old Testament scholar writing about this, says, this vision warns us against any kind of chummy familiarity that fails to acknowledge that the God who, with incredible grace, chooses to live in friendship with the humble, is the transcendent occupant of the throne of the universe. Ezekiel's posture, flat on his face, is a good place to start in response to this awareness. And he's dead on. We cannot take God lightly, but we also cannot pretend that our sins will cut us off from him. And we play on the end of both extremes. So God is present, but he's present in his refining fire. If you saw, he looked up through what the platform of crystal that these creatures were bearing, and he saw a throne of sapphire with the Lord, with Yahweh himself on the throne. The creatures were on fire, but he said the likeness of him was like he was on fire too. And that imagery is always, again, God coming in judgment. But please remember, coming in judgment does not equal coming in destruction. God coming to judge means he's going to separate those who are his people from those who are not. And those who are going to be refined and purified through this process. That's what God is coming to do. He's going to let them know. Any of you who still have confidence that you're going to be out of here soon and go home, that's gone. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. It hasn't been yet. Don't put your hope there. Put your hope in me. But why should they do this? Why should they have hope in a God who let them all be carried off? And here he is in nothing but lightning and fire and the sound of his wings that are beating like an army, like God and like wind all at once. Who looks at all that and says like, well, I'm going to be good. Thank goodness this showed up. I was a little worried before, but now I'm fine. Well, because of what else the author says. He says, like the bow that is in the clouds after the rain was the colors all around him. And again, everything is in this vision for a reason. And so God, while he shows up with imagery of massive judgment, also shows up with an imagery that in Israel's past, or not Israel's, God's people past, said what? I am a God who destroys, but I'm also a God who will not wipe you out. The rainbow that God sent after the flood said, I will never flood this world again. I will never totally wipe you out. I'm going to preserve mankind so that there can be redemption. And so here, in the midst of the fires of judgment, is the rainbow which speaks to them. Whether Ezekiel was able to acknowledge it at the time or not, sounds like he wasn't. Yes, you are a God who judges, but you're a God who's made a promise that the world is going to receive a redeemer through Judah. You can't wipe us out. And you've promised that we're going to be sent home someday. Whether Ezekiel was cognizant of that promise in Isaiah or not, he's going home after 70 years. God will not forget his covenant promises, even though they don't deserve to be the recipients of them. The rainbow speaks that I am a God who judges and who will not judge my people, but I will refine them and I will save them. Let me ask you this. What did the exiles in Babylon do to earn that place in God's plan? As those who would not be destroyed in Jerusalem, but instead be brought to Babylon and sent back with treasures beyond their wildest dreams home again. What did they do to be those who were spared? Did they sin less than the rest who were left in Jerusalem? Were they, because they were so gifted, God just couldn't stand to ruin the ones he'd done a better job creating? I hope that sounds ludicrous to you, because it is. God has a lot of words for these exiles, and a lot of it is condemnation. A lot of it is calling out their sins. A lot of it is demanding that they repent. They are horrible people. And they're spared, and Jerusalem's not. Why is that? Same reason we are. God has done the same thing for you and I. We don't deserve to be part of the remnant that was spared. We didn't do anything to earn our spot here. But yet God comes to us and reminds us, even when we've blown it, I didn't turn away from you. I've not left you. I am more present than you can imagine. If you just get your head on straight, you'd realize that more and more. But don't worry, I'm not leaving that up to you. I'm going to change you more and more so you do think the way I do. And when you've fallen, remember, my covenant says that's paid for. My covenant says my anger has been spent on someone else in your place. My covenant says even though your sins are great, my love has covered you with Christ so that you can be only loved. We will see Ezekiel change throughout these visions. But it takes a while to unlearn that kind of meritocracy behavior. It takes us a while too. But I pray that we will be so comforted by visions like this, that God is a God who judges sin, and it's real, and it's more horrifying than we can imagine, and it will never fall on us. Because Christ said, put it on me, not them. Let them live. Take them home someday. So our life, this side of heaven, is very much the life of an exile. We have a lot of parallels with the people who are living in Babylon, longing to be home in the promised land someday. So Ezekiel's words to them are very much words to us. We must find our hope in what he's going to do for us in the future and not in what we can create for ourselves now. And though he is a God who is holy, he is a God who is merciful and just.